Hello, I'm Oliver Wong. Alas, Morgan Rhodes is away on work obligations today, so I will be flying solo. Today is our second installment of our Art of Sampling series. Last time, if you recall, we discussed an iconic sampling source, the pivotal 1986 anthology by James Brown, In the Jungle Groove. And today we flip things around to look at an album that highlights the power of sampling, and we picked one of the greatest of all time, celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, which is, that just makes me feel old. It is Illmatic, the debut album by QB's finest, Nasty Nas.
Yo, Nas, yo, what the fuck is this bullshit on the radio, son?
Chill, that's the shit, girl, chill.
Hey, yo, pull out a shave, man, let's count this money, man. Hey, yo, Nas, put the jacks, put the brass over there, you know what I'm saying? Cause we've been in the Jacksons, you know how we get down, baby.
True.
If we were going to get into the art of sampling, the first guest that we knew we had to invite was none other than the producer behind our theme song here in Heat Rocks, Thess One. Ever since he started making beats with a cassette player and Gemini sampler, he's racked up one of the most prolific and distinguished catalogs out of Los Angeles, especially as one half of People Under the Stairs alongside his partner Double K. We are talking 10 studio albums, including this year's Swan Song LP, Sincerely the P, plus a dozen other single-only tracks, EPs, remixes, and of course, Thess's solo work and production for other artists. When I first got to know Thess about a dozen years ago, one of the first things I learned about his creative process is that he tries never to use the same drums twice. And that's a cool challenge if you're only making a single album. But when your discography runs into the hundreds of songs, by necessity, you are spending countless hours digging through those proverbial, actually literal crates, hunting for breaks, loops, snippets, anything to flip a hot line into a hot song. Thess One, welcome to Heat Rocks, finally.
Thank you guys for having me.
We've been trying to get you on here for the longest.
You know, I think that it's worth sharing with the listening audience, but I was very reluctant to come on the podcast, not because of you or because I don't appreciate the podcast, but I think it's a weird thing for me to be speaking
about
someone else's work. And it's such an intimate thing. And yeah. I know that I'm going to offend certain people because that's pretty much been my history here.
Well, let's get into it.
Well, particularly because, and I guess I want to say this is, I want to preface whatever's going to happen here in this podcast by saying two things. One, the people behind this record are still around.
Yeah.
And they're still available.
Yeah.
You know, I asked Large Professor to be on our last album and he didn't respond. But, and that leads to number two is that, you know, I think that the perspective that I can bring to this conversation about Illmatic is that, you know, I represent the fans.
Yeah.
I was 16.
Yeah.
You know, and I had just gotten MPC 3000. I was learning the craft. And when the record came out, it shattered my life, you know, because here you took all my favorite producers, you put them together on one record with what was perceivably the best MC at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to say to anyone who's listening to this and anything I might say, and this mostly goes to the old New York dudes who might hear this. I know I wasn't there. And I get, because that's always the thing. They're like, well, you weren't there. I know that. I know I wasn't there. I can't change that. But what I can offer is the perspective of someone who was in the middle of nowhere in the boondocks in San Pedro, California, in a bedroom at my parents' house with headphones on, trying to escape the reality around me, listening to this music that was transmitting to me and speaking to me. And I know there's a lot of people out there who went through the same thing when they heard the record. So I feel like I can speak on behalf of those people. So I feel like if anything, the only thing I can bring to this conversation is maybe speak on behalf of the people who were spending their allowance or the money they got for being a paperboy buying tapes every week.
So let's start here. Were you on that I can't wait for this album to come out?
Yeah.
So was it Live at the Barbecue that started this? Like, how did you get onto the Nas hype train?
From the Source magazine.
The Second Coming article.
It was a lot. There was a lot of rumbling about, and again, I might as well have been on a moon or on Endor. I was in San Pedro, California, but yet I knew about this before, like, the warehouse music up the street knew it was coming. I was there, like, the day it dropped. Like, do you have the Nas record?
Yeah.
And only because we were, you know, I think, I can't overstate this. There was a huge group of people my age, 15 years old, 16 years old, who were really, really up on this. It was my entire identity. You know, like I had no identity, and then hip hop came, and I was like, I'm the one guy at my school who knows the difference between Nasty Nas and, you know, Akineli or whatever. And so that was how I identify myself. So this was this record coming out was like a pivotal thing for my identity too. Like it was going to be, you know.
So what is it about that article that had you so hyped?
I don't think it was just the article. It was just the fact that there was an MC that was, I guess, of Rakim level coming. And we knew he was making material, and as such, the best producers at the very pinnacle of their sort of productive career were giving him music. And Large Professor and Premier and Pete Rock and Q-Tip and all these people who had done stuff on their own were now coming to create this foundation for a record. And it was like mind-boggling to think that could happen. You know?
And I think it's necessary just to give this some context. And you are much more of a student about this than I am. But the impression that I always had about what made Illmatic groundbreaking from a production point of view is that prior to this, yes, you had albums where you might have multiple producers working on it. So even if you just spin back to 1993, go back a year, you know, KRS-One's Return of the Boom Bap had DJ Premier and Showbiz contributed tracks, right? Ice Cube with the Predator had Sir Jinx, Bobcat, and DJ Muggs. But Illmatic was like the equivalent of the Olympic Dream Team coming together. Yeah. Now, am I wrong in saying that was fairly unprecedented? I can't think of another album that had that kind of all-star approach to bringing together a production team.
It wasn't, I think, you're absolutely right. And to add another layer to that, it was a regional all-star team. You know, it'd be like if the basketball dream team was actually just the Lakers, you know, or like some neighborhood group, because you really, there was lineage within the producers. You know, there were people that there was a connection to Marley Marl. There was, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't like they were getting the Dr. Dre to do one track and they were, no, it was like New York is now back and New York is coming for your head. Knowing this was coming, that was the anticipation. The anticipation, I think, was that we all, as fans, we all knew things were going to change and never be the same. We just couldn't picture it. And then it dropped, and it was better, I think, than anyone could have ever expected. I mean, to this day, when you hear the first notes of the first song, not the intro, when you hear the ding, 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 everyone's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. Yo, Black, it's time.
Word.
It's timing.
Then the piano fades in, like it was very deliberate. They didn't give you the beat right away. It was like they toyed with us, and it was like it was huge, man. It's huge.
Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition of pain. I'm like Scarface sniffing cocaine, holding an M16. See with the pen, I'm extreme.
You know, it's slow. It takes its time. You know, again, at this point, myself and I'm sure a lot of other people, we were studying the production technique like really, really deep. So when I heard that, I'm like, oh, my God, he's pulling out the 16th note triplet, which was like becoming like a signature drum pattern. And for people who don't know, 16th note would be like boom, ch, boom, boom, ch. 16th note triplet was boom, ba-ch, ba-boom, ba-ch, boom, ba-ch, ba. And like, that was Premier was like starting to really like hit us with that.
Hell without a capsule. The smooth criminal on beat breaks. Never put me in your box if your shit eats tape. The city never sleeps.
I remember the first time I put the cassette in, you know.
Where'd you cop the cassette from? Was it the warehouse?
I know. I got the cassette. All right, so me and my boy Brian Aranda, he had this Toyota van. And he had these two 16-inch Sherwin Vegas in the back of the van. Like the entire back of the van was Sherwin Vegas subs. They didn't sound good at all, like by any means. And the car rattled so much, you would think it was coming unscrewed around you. I said, hey, man, can we go in your van and buy this cassette at the Tower Records at Del Amo? Because they always had everything first. Tower Records was the best when it came to that.
Yeah.
We go, I get the cassette, we get in the car. And I remember being pissed because we were like halfway home and we hadn't gone through the whole Wild Style intro. And I'm like, you know, like we're almost home. I need this to kick in on his system. And then it dropped. And I was like, there we go. There we go.
This might be a little bit tangential, but I was just thinking about something you were saying a moment ago in regards to the kind of anticipation around this. And I want to say that and I was living in the Bay Area, so I can't speak from this from an LA resident's point of view. But I feel like the whole like East Coast, West Coast thing wasn't really that thick yet. And so I'm wondering that, you know, this album comes out really within less than 2 years, maybe less than a year and a half, when we're still in the influence and the impact of the Chronic.
Right. And supposedly they were working on it. I mean, from what I understand, they were working on this contiguously, 92, 93.
Okay,
you know,
which would make sense.
And back then, for a record to come out, you know, in what was it, May of 94, they would have had to have submitted it, you know, at the end of 93.
Right.
You know.
So I'm just wondering, from a kid, you know, who grew up in San Pedro, did it really matter that this was a New York, such a intensely New York record?
It didn't.
Okay.
Not only did it not matter, I mean, I think we knew, you know, all of us who loved hip-hop, we knew that it was an important record, and we knew that, I don't know how to describe this, like, regionally, it was like we were able to appreciate it for how New York it could be, even if we didn't understand it. You know what I mean? Like, the first time I went to New York on tour, I remember driving down the freeway and seeing all these places that in my mind I had mispronounced because I misunderstood, like, lyrics. Like, I thought New Rochelle was Nervous Shell. And I was like, every time people would say, yo, Nervous Shell. And I'm like, oh, there's a spot that they call the Nervous Shell. I didn't know. You know,
I'm sure I've done the exact same thing.
Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, but, you know, I was waiting for an extremely New York album. Even if I had no idea what that means or what it is, I knew it had to be that way. And I'm sure in the same way that people expected the Chronic to be this extremely over-the-top L.A. like gangster thing. And it kind of was.
And this is, I think, maybe a difficult question to answer, though. To the extent that those two albums, right, The Chronic and Illmatic, are tied so much to locality, to geography, how much of that is carried in the vocals and the lyrics, and how much of that is carried in the sound of the albums?
And the samples that they're using. You know, the Parliament Funkadelic, G-Funk thing, all of that stuff from the West. And then all of a sudden, Illmatic comes and it's slow piano, mostly jazz stuff that was really indicative of what you would find if you were digging for records out in New York. So, yeah, I mean, it was everything. You know, hearing that record and hearing the Heath Brothers, and it was a tour de force of samples, too. And this is after the Beatnuts album and after all this stuff where we had these big, huge loops that changed everything.
Right.
I think that one of the biggest, most important things that happened on Illmatic was Large Professor sampling the Michael Jackson record. It's like saying, okay, everyone's trying to find the craziest, most obscure thing. He turned around and used the most common thing he could and layered NT over it and made a hit. To any listener out there who loves that song, it's worth going on YouTube or somewhere and listening to the demo version of that, which I think is even better and even more raw. There's a demo version of It Ain't Hard to Tell where Large Professor uses a different part of the Michael Jackson record. And it's insane. It's like a maniac. With this, see, I'm a brainiac. I call you tattoo, you never come on. I flip the script with a sword off, of course. I'm out of Shakespeare, reincarnated. Brains are elevated, I'm being R-rated. This style is terror, drastic. Melting the plastic, and I eat mics. Different lyrics, too. Well, yeah, different, but mostly the same. It's the delivery is different.
Yeah.
Because the drum pattern is different. Which shows the mastery of both the producer and why beats are important.
So on this song in particular, a couple things. Number one, in just confession on my part, never really loved this track.
Oh my God.
When it first came out, and this, we have to, again, put this in the context of the anticipation behind Illmatic and Nas in general, not even before the album, because this first single dropped before we got the album, right? But based off of Live of the Barbecue, based off, you know, him, his guest verse on Back to the Grill Again by MC Search. I just wanted whatever that first Nas single was going to be, and of course, Halftime off the Zebrahead soundtrack. I just wanted that first single for this album to be something that was just kind of like melt my mind. Mm-hmm. And as much as I admire, to your point, like what Large Professor is doing, how he flips the Michael Jackson, and I think to your point also, that whether or not, and I've never spoken to Large Professor about this, but him deliberately was, you know, was he deliberately choosing a Michael Jackson track because he wanted to show you, I'm going to take human nature, this massive pop hit, and I'm making this underground.
It's like going to a Michelin 3-star and you sit down, and the guy gives you a hot dog.
Right.
And you're like, what? Right.
He's like, he's flexing, basically.
He's flexing on you.
So as much as I respect that, I'm just like, I just want to think harder. And I think you can say a lot of things about It Ain't Hard to Tell. To me, it is not a hard track. Compared to, and this is one of the remixes of this song that I really love, is by a mutual acquaintance, actually a good friend of yours, which is DJ Day's flip on this. Mm. That to me, I'm not saying it's better. I'm just saying is the sound of Day's remix is kind of what I wanted this to feel like, which is something that just slapped me upside my head. Righteous steps, deep like the shining, sparkle like a diamond, sneak a Uzi on the island, and my army jacket lining, hit the earth like a comet, invasion, Nazis like the Afro-Centrian, half man, half amazing. Well, I think on that, to that note, it's worth saying that at the time, this was the entirety of the rap industry.
You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't a commercial rap industry. Like, this was it.
Right.
And Sony had an expectation that this was going to sell.
Right.
And for all practical purposes, this record flopped. You know, considering the hype, considering everything, it took way too long to go gold and way too long to go platinum.
Yeah.
Nowadays, like, Beer Bongs and Bentleys goes platinum before, you know what I mean? Like, immediately.
Right. This was a slow burn from an industry point of view.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that when, if, you know, again, I'm just speculating because I'm a fan, not a person in the industry. And it's funny because the industry of that time, it was all about, like, name dropping. And they're like, oh, you know, so-and-so over at Sony and this and that. I don't know any of the people making the decisions, but someone listened to the record and made the decision, this is going to be the single, probably because they felt it was the most accessible
song. Because it is using Human Nature and all that stuff.
Right.
Since we've gone down the It Ain't Hard to Tell rabbit hole, right? We've listened to a remix, we've listened to a demo. We also got to acknowledge, you know, Large Professor for like the promo 12-inch version of the single flips, and I think this is actually one of my favorite flips of anything connected with Illmatic, is he takes Biz Markie saying highly recognized as the king of disco.
Right. Nah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Brilliant. The boot amongst in your trunk, turn the bass up, not stories by Aesop. Place your loot up, parties are shoot up. That's the reason why I will always say, and I firmly believe that Large Professor is the greatest producer and most important producer of all time and the most underrated. I don't feel he gets credit.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at just from a, if everyone's going to say, okay, Illmatic is one of the best produced hip hop golden era albums of all time. Well, he has the most beats on it. He's got 3 beats on that record. Everyone else has 1.
I'm pretty sure Primo also, I think both of them had 3. So it's kind of balanced between the two. But anyways, go.
It is. And I think when these discussions occur, Primo always gets listed as.
Yes.
Always. Like, right. No one ever leaves Premier off the top 5 producers of all time.
Sure.
And I feel like Large Pro gets left off the list almost indefinitely.
Right. And I think partly it's because his solo career never took off in the same way that I think we kind of wanted. And that's a lot of label shenanigans and probably some other stuff that we don't know about. But
from a technical standpoint, as someone who really studied and had to figure out my own lane in production, I think more often than not, what Large Professor did with a sampler really changed. He was never like a one-trick pony, you know? Like, for instance, the Resurrection remix by Common. I remember the first time I heard that, I was like, this can't even be a record. Like, this can't even be a sample. It's too perfect. It is too good. It was unbelievable. My mind was blown. Rhythm like a swim bike with a dim light. I use insight to enlighten, write something in skin tight. Words of wisdom well from my windpipe. Imagination's in flight. I send light like Ben's kite. I've been right. We'll get back into the
specifics of Illmatic tracks, but if I can just pull the scope back for a second, because you were mentioning earlier, this album came out when you'd gotten your first MPC. You'd already been working in the bedroom at that
16
point.
16 or 17.
What did this album teach you about production? And in particular, if you can talk about, what did it teach you about sort of sample hunting? Because you've already started to allude to some of this.
Well, I think it's the first or the best example that you ever got of maybe the only where, okay, here's all these producers that I want to emulate. I'm not going to say bite, but, you know, let's be fair. Like, the only reason I know about Premier's 16th note triplet is because we, Double K and I, would replicate it over and over again. How did he do that? how did he get the swing just right on this Bubba Chip? It was a, we used to call it the Bubba Chip because he was like Bubba Chip. If you heard it and you were trying to redo it, it was very easy to not do it right. There was a certain pocket to it.
Yeah.
And when you look at Illmatic and you look at, okay, here's all of the producers I want to emulate, but they're all working with the same MC and they all know what Nas sounds like. So this is the first time I feel like you got all these guys in one aquarium and you could actually see how they're dealing with him differently. And everyone's production styles, I think what made each one of the producers on Illmatic's production style iconic is showcased. Like they all brought their best tricks, if that makes sense, you know? So you've got Q-Tip with the you know, the kick and the snare on the Q-Tip beat are very iconic Q-Tip of that era. And
One Love. We're talking about One Love.
Yeah, right. And the way that he layered it with the loop does the heavy lifting.
Yo, what's the letter I got from my man Nas, man? Where was this born?
What it say, kid?
What up, kid? I know shit is rough doing your bit. When the cops came, you should have slid to my crib. Fuck it, Black, no time for looking back is done. Plus, congratulations, you know you got a son. I heard he looks like...
Oh, but that was very Q-Tip at the time. As opposed to, say, you know, like the stuff we've been listening to, New York State of Mind, where it's very, very premier of the era. And I feel like everyone brought their characteristic and put it on showcase. Maybe subconsciously so that they could separate themselves from the guy that they knew was going to be. Because, I mean, there had to have been... I know if someone told me, hey, there's this new MC, this potentially could be the greatest rap album of all time. And I said, who else do you have producing it? And they told me,
yeah,
I would sit down long and hard and be like, this has to be my best.
Right.
So this album gave me, a guy who was trying to learn how to produce and be good at it, an opportunity to hear everyone basically, like, you know, trying to outdo each other.
Yeah. While we're at this kind of more meta level, I am wondering, though, to the extent that Illmatic, as we were talking about earlier, represented this all-star dream team formation of production, and it really shifted, I think, things, or began. It wasn't like it happened overnight, but I think this album helped to begin to shift this idea that if you're going to be a hot MC, you got to do the same thing. You got to get a collection of the best producers in the game, as opposed to the one rapper, one producer model, which is frankly the model that you and Double K follow throughout the history of People Under the Stairs. I mean, has there ever been an outside producer who worked on any of your 10 albums? Right. Mm-hmm. So that ethos was really important to you. I mean, it's the Guru Primo.
Right. It was P-Rock and Sail Smooth. Almost all the people that were producers were coming out of that.
So, you know, you fast forward a few years, and certainly like 10 years later after Illmatic, this becomes the norm, is that you never just work with a single producer unless you're broke and just starting off. Right. But if you have the money, you go out and you get the finest. And I feel like the downside of that is it creates kind of this inconsistent sonic palette to a lot of albums. Mm-hmm. So it's very impressive on paper. Oh, you got blank, blank, and blank. But the final product that kind of lacks a certain kind of, you know, coherence, I think, as a consequence. And do you think that Illmatic, in a sense, as great as this album might have been, kind of marked the beginning of the end?
Absolutely. When you took all of the best and put them together, but you made it so cohesive, it almost boxed hip-hop in. And it opened the door for Puffy and Biggie and, like, all these things to come and make it, like, I guess what, I mean, this is, not to get too meta here, like, whatever, but I spent an enormous amount of time thinking about this sort of stuff on plane rides and train rides and being on tour, so I apologize in advance if I'm going to go off in a weird note, but you have to wonder, you know, what is it when people are like, the golden era and this and that, like, why is it then and not now?
Yeah.
And I think what happens is when you have something so perfect or close to perfect, then there's nowhere left to go. And you have to go outside of that because no one wants to continue to be compared to Illmatic. And again, also Illmatic, I think if you were me, 15-year-old me, who was buying 3 tapes a week, you were ready for Illmatic, but then you were probably ready to, like, move on, you know? Because I had to sit through the Pudgy the Fat Bastard tape because I bought it. And I had, you know...
The slander against Pudgy.
Oh. I had, you know, I mean, they weren't great records.
No.
They weren't great. There was a lot of really bad New York rap records that I purchased and I got behind and I supported them, but in retrospect, they don't stand up. And I ride for some of them, too. Like, I ride for the Rumpelstiltskin's album. I haven't listened to it in a long time, but, you know,
wow,
this is the level that we were at. I'm J-Rock, the DJ, and myself used to be in this record store called Stax, and we used to just play this game where we would just list the most ridiculous underground rap records that we bought. You know, he'd be like, hey man, you got that Milkbone 12 inch for me? I'd be like, nah, bro, I traded it for the blank, you know. And for hours we would just,
oh my god,
just this encyclopedic knowledge of just sort of random
nerding out
stuff. So totally. When you're that deep into the culture and you've listened to everything, to hear something like this and acknowledge it, like that's why this record matters, you know.
All right, well, we will get back into the specifics of Illmatic with our special guest Thess One, but first, take a listen to some of our wonderful Sibling Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
What do you look for in a book?
Literally, if on the back it said, like, this book made me shit my pants, I'd be like, I'm buying this book.
Yeah.
Like, I think the problem with blurbs a lot of times...
I like that we both want to crap ourselves over books.
What's the best way to e-read in the tub?
Listen to that noise. I'm reviewing a plastic bag today.
How do you find a good book?
This is the most fucked up weird shit you've ever read. You're like into it.
I'm like,
hand it over.
Take my money.
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara. We're Reading Glasses and we solve all your bookish problems every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
All right. Song is about some books. One, two, one, two, three, four.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And together we're the hosts of Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. What does that mean for you, the podcast consumer? Well, it means that you're going to get a lot of stories about how we used to do weird stuff to people in order to try to fix them.
Do you know that we used to think diseases were caused by bad smells? And that we used to eat mummies for medicine?
That's super funny. I kind of like it.
Well, thanks, and we hope you'll kind of like our show, Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. It's available every Friday wherever fine podcasts are sold, or at its beautiful, picturesque home at
MaximumFun.org.
All right.
Yeah.
We are back here on Heat Rocks with our special guest, Thess One, People Under the Stairs, and we are talking about The Art of Sampling on Nas's debut from 25 years ago, Illmatic. Thess, you were saying earlier about, you know, listening to this for the first time on the cassette and just sort of the impressions that were made. I'm wondering what song, if you had to pick, and this might be just sort of like killing your darlings here, but if you had to pick only one song here that you think, from a production, from a sample point of view, whatever, that you think is just like pinnacle status, what is it?
It's easier for me to tell you which song shouldn't be on the record.
Actually, you know what? I love that. Let's start with that. Yeah. What would you have left off?
One time for your mind.
Okay. Why?
I just don't feel, it feels anticlimactic, especially when you hear Represent come in after it.
So is it a sequencing problem? Or are you just thinking?
No, okay. I don't think it has the most amount of lyrical content that makes it memorable. I feel like the beat is great, and on any other record it might be the best beat on the record, but here in the Parthenon it doesn't impress. You know, it's like when you're in the Louvre and you're like looking at all these great Da Vinci's and all this stuff, and then there's like the one rando dude and you're like, "Ah, De La Croix is cool, but
yeah, it's Illmatic."
Yeah.
It's Illmatic.
Yeah.
It's Illmatic.
One time for your mind, one time.
Yeah, whatever. One
time. And if you want to know what specifically bothers, now that we're listening to it, I remember thinking this, is that the sort of cheesy patch ride open high, like it's like a ride cymbal that's really, really high up from a fidelity standpoint. It's probably in like 15-16K. Seemed out of place on this grimy, dark New York record. It seemed too shiny. It seemed, I don't know, it just didn't feel like it matched me.
Spends the night for sexing, keep lubrication, lifestyle protection, picking up my stereos, remote control quickly, Ron G's in the cassette deck, rocking the shit, G.
I always kind of like this beat.
I'm nitpicking.
No, I know. No. Well, here, I'm gonna commit some blasphemy here.
Here comes the hate mail already.
No. Well, I think it's going to be maybe more directed towards me. The one song on here I have never liked, and in 25 years, I've never changed my mind on this, Life's a Bitch. And it's because that Gap Band, Yearning for Your Love Loop, I mean, it's a great song.
You guys can't see this in Radio Land, but I am shaking my head and rolling my eyes and looking at this dude sideways.
It was
right
too
now.
Smooth and too slick.
Oh my
like,
God.
I just could not roll with it. Like, there's no snare on this. Like, I couldn't hang with it.
Well, I think you have a similar thing with It Ain't Hard to Tell, where you have this sort of, it was nostalgic. I remember my parents playing this song. Yeah, so there was, there was definitely some nostalgia element there, which made, I think, it made it that much more. I mean, again, I wouldn't attribute the beat being great to my own nostalgia. So I understand where you're coming from. But I do think that in this instance, Nas really shows his ability for the first time on the record in terms of sequencing. He shows his ability to change his delivery and his content based upon the feeling of the beat. And a lot of MCs of that era and of that time, they would bludgeon a beat with their MC-ness. They were scientifical, whether the beat was happy or sad or mellow or hard, didn't matter. They were coming at you with some lyrics. And I feel like now we see a general artistry of Nas going, okay, he's riding the vibe of the beat and the content of his lyrics really, I don't know, like that combined with the beat make the song to me for the first time on the record. Because before this, you're just getting a lot of New York, East Coast, criminal slang,
right?
You know,
right.
And now you're getting a more pensive, a more thoughtful Nas. And it's not something that we were used to. It was almost unexpected, I thought.
I think it was totally unexpected. And I think maybe, and this goes back to the sequencing, because it's like the third track on the album and it comes right after New York State of Mind, I just feel like if they'd put it
a little later,
deeper, yeah. I think I would have been more okay with it.
I wanted to be an MC or producer or in music. I wanted to be this from a very, very young age. And I remember listening to records and really appreciating when someone would end side A with a song like this. So if I had to resequence it, and if I was there helping with the record, which I wasn't, I know I wasn't there, but I would have put this song at the end of side A. So I would have looked at the total runtime of the record,
which is like 40 minutes,
right?
Or something.
Easy,
yeah, sure.
It's easy. You can figure it out and go, okay, if we're gonna have four songs on each side or whatever it is, this is gonna be the last song on side A.
Yeah.
And I learned this from listening to records that did that effectively. Beat Nuts, Street Level, or whatever it's called. I don't know.
Self-titled Street Level. Sure.
I think they did that very effectively on that record. I feel like the first Black Sheep album did that very effectively. There's ways that people were doing this where you were like, the side ends, you take a breath, you flip and then you start again.
Boom. Right, right. You know. So I'm going to come back to this though. What is the one song when you first listened or when you listen to it now that from a sampling production point of view, you're like, God damn, that was good. Besides all of them, or almost all of them, besides One Time for Your Mind.
Well, I mean. That Ain't Hard to Tell demo that we played earlier,
yeah,
for sure, really gets me every time. And maybe the reason why is because it's such a raw take.
Yeah.
I think a lot of my nostalgia towards hip hop and towards this is going back to being a teenager smoking blunts in a room with the sampler, and that really takes me back to that. Hearing the tape warble but Represent was pretty dope.
And a song that it's the second to last, and it's like, yo, why did you bury this? All the way at the back.
I didn't see that as a bury.
Okay.
I feel like if you look at classic hip hop albums of that era, Second to Last is a very important song.
The penultimate.
Well, if you look at Midnight Marauders, the record quote unquote ends and then it comes back in with Lyrics to Go. And Lyrics to Go from a product, when I heard that, I was like, are you kidding me? Minnie Riperton singing loop like this, like with ding, 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 ding. I was like, steam was coming out of my ears.
Yeah. The beat with the mic and it's over. Try to request me on the run for whatever. Trials and tribulations that we have to endeavor. Brothers know my sealer with a letter to the better. If you see your shorty that you like, then you're
so better. The second to last track was, I felt like, was almost like the track where you really had to just seal it. And then the last one could be whatever.
Right. Nas is a rebel of the street corner. Pulling the tech out the dresser. Police got me under pressure.
You know, if you look at the drum programming, right? You know, I was talking about the 16th note triplet earlier. This one really, really has it in spades. And if you listen to the end, right before it comes back around again, there's a very low 16th note triplet kick right before the loop comes back around. See that?
But you...
and that triplet right before the snare, another classic Cream thing where it's like, what's happening?
Straight up shit is real, and any day could be your last in the jungle. Get murdered on the humble, guns of blast.
When I heard that, I was like, he's taking the loop, and it's making a seamless transition, because there's actually like an unfinished drum programming thought right before it loops back around again. It made it sound not like drum programming.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, I mean, hearing this stuff and going, damn, dude, how did he get it to sound so natural?
And how about the main melody loop, The Thief of Baghdad? I think this came off of what, like a soundtrack or something? By
I don't
Lee
even
Irwin?
Know. I don't even have it.
Right, and I could be wrong. I feel like this was one of those mystery samples for years on end. Like, it
for
took
sure.
a long time to people figure it out. But this goes back to your previous point that you were talking about in the first half, is that, you know, it was a competition to find the stuff that nobody else had flipped yet. And yeah. I think Represent and what Primo did with this is a great example of, like, finding something from nothing, so to say.
Sure, and in showing his, you know, if you were to talk about all these producers having superpowers, in my mind, right?
Yeah.
Premier's superpower was being able to take something and chop it and present it in a way. Like, if you look at Group Home Superstar, when I heard that, I was just like, and then I heard, and if you listen to that and then you listen to the original, it's mind blowing. Like, the artistry there.
Right.
Life to choose. I wanna make money, so I gotta pay dues. But there's no rules, and you only have one chance. If you fuck up, kid, you face the circumstance. At night, I used to scream and shout, living in the ghetto, trying to get.
And this is a similar thing where, like, you know, the original is less important than what he made out of it, which is
sure.
totally different than the Heath Brothers, where what he made out of it is the original.
Right.
So different styles, different superpowers.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you brought up One Love, because I was just about to make the same observation, is that I think on the complete other side of this is One Love, produced by Q-Tip. So this is the Heath Brothers jazz group. That is the Smilin' Billy Suite Part 2, if I'm not mistaken. That distinctive sound is a Kalimba thumb piano. And we're going to have an episode in a couple weeks with Raphael Sadiq, and we're talking about Earth, Wind, and Fire, and we'll be talking about the Kalimba again. But so that's the original source, right? And then this is what Q-Tip does on One Love for Illmatic.
I mean, you know, you don't hear the 16th note triplet drum programming. It actually occurs in the sample. But Q-Tip's mastery there, I feel like, is the way that he was able to layer the two things together. And I'm not sure because, I wasn't there, but it sounds to me like they filtered the record. They split the loop into two parts, a bass part and a high part, filtered out some of the mid-range to make room for the drums. So it's a brilliant beat from a technical standpoint as well, but it's entirely different from what we would expect from Premiere or
right.
from anyone else. And I think it's worth noting, to go against criticism, music criticism, not negative criticism, but music critical thinking about this record, especially about the production side of it. You know, like, you know, the producers were using the records they found in their parents' record collections. Like, that's not true. You know, that minimizes the enormous impact and how much work people were doing to try and find the samples and the loops on the record.
Right.
Even before this record dropped, if you were to go to PCC or you to go to a record swap, this record was $300 on the wall. You know, this was a known record. It was who was going to use it first and who was going to buy it, use it. So these sort of Everest loops existed. They were expensive. Other things that come to mind were like Power of Zeus, Hell's Bell drums. Like, all these things were known commodities.
Right.
It's like, who's going to buy it, sample it, and use it first? I remember seeing, so there was this guy named Mustafa who used to go to PCC swap. And he would roll in with bodyguards and security at the record swap.
Wow.
Because he had all of the records. You know, he was on this game early, and I don't know where he was coming from. He might have been trucking out here from the East Coast, and I got, you know, I got a ton of Mustafa stories, but I don't even know if half of them are true. He was, from what I understand, again, you hear this from me, he may have been bootlegging certain expensive records like New Band and New Band 2 on Guinness and passing them off as real. Again, I don't know. I heard he got locked up one night and the Japanese record dealers who flew out from Tokyo bailed him out so he could be at the record show. You know, this was mafia stuff trying to get these records. And these were expensive records regardless, because sampling didn't just start with Illmatic. We were knee deep in good samples before that. So it was like, how are we going to outdo Showbiz and AG? How are we going to outdo Large Professor using third guitar? That was an expensive record before.
Right.
So these were massive, like, you know, things that people were doing. And if you were into it and you were into the scene, you heard this, you were like, I'm being flexed on right now. Like, these dudes are killing me.
Now, you were mentioning earlier that you study this album from a technique point of view, right? Mm-hmm. You were trying to understand, back, reverse engineer, like, what are they doing with the program?
Same thing that I'm sure people did to a Charlie Parker record back in there, whatever.
I'm wondering, too, though, to what extent, if you were a sample hunter, did this make you want to chase anything to figure out, to find the sample source? Like the Ahmad Jamal album,
for example. For sure. Like, they were, you know, all of us who were on the hunt back then, it wasn't just what the sample was. You know, we would find the original record and then we go, all right, who played on this? Who produced it? What label was it on?
Right.
Are there other records that sound like this? After this one, it was like, what else on Strata sounds like this? Well, unfortunately, nothing really sounds just, this is a pretty unique record.
Which is
why it was an easy record. Even if you're a record dealer and you know nothing about records, you could drop the needle on this and go, I think someone who makes hip hop beats is going to want this.
Yeah.
You know, and over my career of traveling the world, touring, and meeting up with record dealers, one of the things I hated most, that, like, I never told them because I try to be chill with them, but I hated when people would pull a record out and be like, yo, this sounds like some people in stereo shit right here. I used to be like, I hope that I never end up at a point where people, a random record dealer can pinpoint, and they were never right, but something like this so obvious, I'm sure some guy pulled it and was like, this sounds like a hip-hop beat, you know? Funky drummer, that sounds like a hip-hop beat.
Sure.
It's easy, you know.
Yeah.
Loop it up.
That's funny, though, and again, not to go out too off on the tangent, so you would have people basically trying to guess what they thought you would want to listen to in terms of, from a sample source.
Yeah, they would throw me records, and he'd be like, it sounds like people on a stereo shit, whatever. And it's funny because it was always wrong. The only person, and he never said it like this, but the only person I would ever even listen, entertain that would be Cool Chris. Cool Chris would be like,
Groove Merchant in San Francisco.
Yeah. He'd be like, I think you should listen to this. And I would drop everything and listen to it. And he was right 100% of the time. And he's responsible for three or four of my especially when we were working on Question in the Form of an Answer, he gave me the record for Youth Explosion. He gave me the record for The Cat. And these were records that, like, I didn't find. He was like, I think you should listen to this.
Yeah.
Damn.
Shout out to Cool Chris. I mean,
he's the best.
Yeah,
he was like a drug dealer.
One of my favorite guys of all time. So bringing this back to Illmatic, was there anything on here that turned you on to an artist or an album that you didn't know about before?
No, but I think hearing how Large Pro did Human Nature really made me think, like, wait a minute, it isn't even about the record anymore. It's about the technique.
Mm.
That was the revelation. The revelation wasn't, oh my God, Smiling Billy Sweet's amazing. It is, but also Human Nature. It's almost like we had been overlooking this stuff. We had been looking at the stars,
right?
And what we were looking for was inside us the whole time. Damn you, Large Pro, you know?
So we somehow have managed not to talk yet really at all about Pete Rock and what he does on The World Is Yours.
The world is yours, the world is yours.
It's mine. I love this. Sorry, I should have said, I didn't mention this song because it goes without saying what an amazing beat and song it is. And I'm a huge Pete Rock fan too.
Yeah.
I always love the first second I heard it, there's a hi-hat that comes in. I can't remember if it's on the sample or if he added it, but it's on the upbeat. Very Pete Rock, and this probably wasn't intentional, but, you know, Pete has a strong, in my mind, a strong connection to Jamaican music and Jamaican rhythms. And there's this, when you listen to reggae drumming or Jamaican drumming, there's the upbeat is important. You know, the up, not the down. It's the
right.
up. And on this beat, there's a hi-hat on the upbeat. You never hear that in a hip-hop beat, ever. Hear it? Bing, bing. It's on the upbeat. Weird. It's a weird, it's a very Jamaican to have that hi-hat on the ing, ding, doo, 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 doo,
right.
doo, ing. Hmm. And I don't think, I'd have to listen to the Ahmad Jamal, but I don't think that hi-hat is in the sample, mm-hmm. which makes it that much better to me that it's just there.
I'm almost 100% positive it's not.
It's an acoustic piano record.
Right.
I don't think it is.
Yeah. Do I want to say, and let's get into the Ahmad Jamal. I mean, this is the song that Pete Rock was using is I Love Music by Ahmad Jamal.
Complete weather cruising in a six cab. I'm on tarot deep, I can't call it. The beats make me falling asleep. I keep falling, but never falling 6 feet deep. I'm out for presidents to represent me.
And this is, I think, another one of those examples where if I were just to play you the original source, like 9 times out of 10, unless you're purposely listening for it,
right.
you wouldn't hear this go the original song go by and be like, oh shit, there's that nod
right.
to it. Like,
right.
Pete Rock found like something, I won't say it's out of nothing, because this whole Ahmad Jamal album, it's called The Awakening, is sublime. I mean, mm-hmm. it's really one of my favorite jazz albums, probably because like 18 different people have sampled from it, but they've all chosen different parts of the
right.
album. And
right.
so it's kind of interesting. And again, I wasn't there, you weren't there. But I imagine to some extent, like this album probably circulated around all those record fair, like the ballroom scenes. But because producers would be competitive, just because Pete Rock used part of this song, they're not going to use the same part,
right.
but they're going to find a different loop on a different song, even the same song, just use a different part of it.
Yeah. And that, there's a lot of records that were like that circulated. And I heard this talking to dealers from back then, where they would have 3 copies of Milt Jackson record on impulse. And here's one for you. And then everyone left the swap that day with this new discovery. And it was like,
right.
all right, again, an arms race. Who's going to use the loop first? And
right.
if that person uses it, we can't use this part anymore. But that was also why you would hear 2 songs drop in close proximity to each other with the same loop. I'm thinking about the Large Professor.
Q-tip thing. Jazz. We got the jazz.
Same thing with, you know, when Monty Alexander Razz. All of a sudden, everyone's using Monty Alexander Razz. You got Gangsta Bitch and you got the Beatness. And it's like, dope. It's a dope sound. It's obvious. When you hear that, you go, oh my God, this is again, that's a Smiling Billy Sweet. You hear it and
right.
you go,
pff.
No one to blame, no shame in the game. And when we fuck, she makes me scream out her name. She's not petty, confident, ready.
And the Beat Nuts and their brilliance, they were like, we'll just loop it, rap over it.
Check it, I can make you dance, make you lay way back. Fast styles become a sack when I rip up tracks. Kicking back, I sit back and puff up, feel the coolest, so damn chill, freezing.
But for the Pete Rock thing, for the Ahmad Jamal, again, I think this is Pete. I don't know the timeline here. I don't know if he knew it was for Nas or he just made the beat, but it is the perfect beat for Nas for this record. It's that dark, slow plodding type of beat. I'm sure that Pete Rock and Nas and Large Pork to sit down and listen to this and be like, these guys don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Well, we weren't there.
I don't know. I mean, you know, not to be super postmodern here, but you know,
I've read interviews, you know, I think when the album turned 20, which 5 years ago, right? There was a lot of like oral histories, making up type stuff. And I think every story I've ever read about the making of Illmatic, it's because Nas was so highly anticipated. Like, this was not just about a paycheck for these guys in terms of, hey, we want to give you
right.
this money. It's because, holy shit, this is the second coming. This is the next Rakim. Because they knew, oh shit, Pete's working on this. Q-Tip's working on this. Yeah, of course they're all going to bring their A game. It's hip hop. These guys are hyper competitive.
I think ultimately that's what matters, that it's hip hop. And hip hop is rooted in competition and in battle.
right,
and embodying someone, whether this was the pinnacle or close to it or somewhere along the way, it's definitely, I think, a very important moment in time.
One song we have not mentioned yet, and this is, to me, one of my favorites, and I don't know, I'm trying to remember if this was one of my favorites from Jump. I think, and again, for an album that's 25 years old, your relationship to it, and at least for some people, at least in my case, it has shifted over time. I think if you had asked me 20, 25 years ago what my favorite song off of here, it would have been One Love. And a lot of it does have to do with like the work that Heath Brothers loop does.
Right.
I think today it would certainly be New York State of Mind, which was a song which I'm going to freely confess to. When I first heard this album, like literally brought it home and listened to it, was not that into New York State of Mind. I think because it was a little too dark for me. Yeah. I'm like, where's the melody at?
Right.
Right. Nowadays, like that song's incredible. One of the best, like first songs on the album, but whatever. But Memory Lane to me is definitely, if New York State of Mind is 1A, then Memory Lane is 1B. Another primo loop production, very different from New York State of Mind in feel. It's more on that nostalgic tip. He's working with a kind of late era Blue Note album by Reuben Wilson, We're in Love. And it's a combination of I love the loop, and the way that Nas just flows right over this is magical.
Chill on the block with Carniac Coast Strap. With my beef that's in the drug money market interact. No sign of the beast and a blue Chrysler. I guess that means peace for niggas. No shice device to just snipe ya. Start off the dice, roll the match for crap to CeeLo.
I'm definitely not a good MC. And this song in particular, I've been listening to this song for a quarter century. As much as I try to rap to this in the car, I can never nail the cadence. Never. And again, I'm not particularly good at it, at rapping, so maybe that's part of it. But I just think the work that he's doing here and the relationship somehow between his flow and the beat.
Yeah, and the drum programming is, again, it's premier with the triplets. It's unusual because you got this boom, boom thing, really, really a lot of kick drums on the one when it comes around, more than you typically hear from premier. There's a lot of action when the loop comes back around. I know, I love it. I think it's an amazing song, but Nas is just, he's swinging for the fences on this one. He's going ham bone here.
Yeah.
And he didn't have to. I didn't mention this when we were talking about, what's the first song?
What, New York State of Mind, you mean?
New York State of Mind. And this song and the premiere beats, I think here we find a very confident premiere. And when you hear premiere doing these cuts, sometimes not even using the crossfader, that to me is that cool jazz transition where he's just like, I am so good at what I'm doing here. It's all about the pocket and the swing and not about, like, the technique is the performance, but not like, it's not hamster crab. It's just, he's in the
clean,
pocket.
Right.
Clean. I mean, just, it's about the tone and the performance and not this. And again, he's firing shots at everybody because he knows no one can do this. I mean a lot of people can cut a record, but no one can cut like Premier.
No, I think this is a great
point.
So
deliberate.
I think it's a great point because I think I've talked to a lot of people over the years and they all say the same thing about Primo when it comes to his chorus cuts is that, again, from a technical point of view, it was never the most intricate, but it was always clean. His choices were impeccable and it just sounded good. You didn't have to have like the best, again, virtuosic skill with the fader. You just needed to know how to do it. And I think that that's one of the things that Primo just master.
Yeah, and if you go back to the first song on the record, it has that long fade out with him doing some very deliberate scratches, and it's almost like getting punched slowly by someone who knows they're going to kick your ass. you're just like, you know, because it's the first cut you hear on the record as the song's fading out, and it's, what's the cut he's doing? Nasty Nas. And you're just like, I know this record's going to be amazing.
Yeah. We actually, the one song we have not talked about is actually the very first, and technically was not the single from the album, but was the single that came out previous to the album, which is Halftime. And as I mentioned, the first half off of the Zebrahead soundtrack, which not a soundtrack I think most people remember, but this is one of the memorable things off of it.
Damn thing gonna change. I'm gonna perform a strange show. The mic warmer was born the game. Nas, why did you do it? You know you got the mad fat fluid when you rhyme. It's halftime.
Large Professor once again.
Large Pro, and it's so of its time. You know, like
the horns in particular.
The horn with the 16th note fade out, where it's like, oh, but also what really dates it for me, if I was an archaeologist and I'd go back, I'd be like, you see the use of the sleigh bell. Sleigh bells are really can date a record. It's better than carbon dating. You can put it between about 5 months in hip hop. I remember when I got the MPC, that it had the patch discs. And really, you didn't want to use those, I think. But it was funny when I heard the sleigh bell on there. I was like, this is the sleigh bell. It's the sleigh bell, the Akai sleigh bell. And I used it. I don't know if people were using it because of the Million Silly Break. I don't know if you know that.
It's a Christmas record.
It's a Christmas record.
Yeah.
Why all of a sudden for like a year were sleigh bells an important thing? And I don't know who started it. I think the Beatnuts started it.
I mean, Pete Rock used those sleigh bells heavy too.
No, everyone was using the sleigh bell for a while. It's like Mountain. Pete Rock had Mountain on lock. Like if someone else used Mountain, I mean, other people did, but really, if you listen to Mech and the Soul Brother, you know, 89% of that record is Mountain live.
And this is, again, Drum Break by
Again, this
Rock
is nerdery.
Group.
This is the abyss of record nerdery, where right. We're looking at someone who is using the same record over and over again on different beats. Not, I think, because they're lazy, because it gave a signature sound. You know, again, it's like a chef, and he's using the same ingredient over and over and over again. And then you go, yeah, I know this is Roy Choi or something.
Right,
you
right. Know? Yeah, the signature in that
signature.
Sense.
You got that?
If you had to describe Illmatic in three words, what three words would you choose?
Oh, man. I don't know. Represent.
Because representing is Illmatic, as I was told.
There you go. There's the three words. Representing is Illmatic. Actually, time is Illmatic. When I think of the record, like if you say Illmatic, all I can hear in my head are like all these guys yelling, represent, represent. And it's funny because, again, you know how I was telling you about how I thought Nervous Shell was a place in New York? Like, I also know all of the members of, like, I know they're like, what does Wallet Head look like? Like, what does Big Oogie look like? You know
Big
what I mean?
Oogie.
Yeah, what's Big Oogie look like? Like, as a fan, you're laying in your room in the dark listening to this, thinking about how amazing this is, and you're trying to envision all these characters. And I think,
right.
You know, there was so much meat there for us as fans. There was so much to unpack. And, God, I sound like a freaking critic.
Shout out to Cormega. He gets two shouts on this album.
Shout to Cormega. Shout out to all the, yeah, Wallet Head. Where's Wallet Head now?
This is all, and I think what Thess is referring to is at the end of, I think it's at the end of Memory Lane is when.
He shouts out all maybe, the Queensbridge dudes.
Or maybe it's the end of Represent. That would probably make more sense. Yeah. But yeah, it's a very long, like, list of names
right.
of just people from Queensbridge.
Like, if I was an animator, I would animate that part, and I would have, like, as he's saying it, and I would have the caricature
person.
Of Wallet Head and
Big Oogie
and all these guys, and like all these. I wish someone would give me a budget, you know, and I just let me animate ridiculous raps, like things that people did in rap music that now are so ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
Billy's, my man Slate, Wallet Head, Black J, Big Oogie, Oogie, Crazy Barrier, Spot.
Big Dog.
We rock shit a lot.
Top
PhD and my man Primo, Gangstar.
Well, with that, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks, part two of our sampling series. Special thanks to our special guest, Thess One. So Thess, I mean, as you very publicly stated earlier this year, People Under the Stairs has retired.
Right. So don't send me no hate mail because I retired.
But what are you up to now? What are you working on?
My biggest project right now is trying to take my kids to see the world in the way that I saw it. And because, Double K and I were fortunate enough to tour for 20 years and we saw damn near every continent. And now I learned more from that than I learned from anything else. And so now I want to try and expose my young kids to that. So, I'm basically like a travel agent. I just sit around and try and find cheap flights, get them out there. And I'm still making music. I'll never stop making music and mentoring young people and doing whatever I can. I do a lot of podcasts. As a guest, it's a career, and at some point I think I'd love to probably pass on some of this, whether in a book format or as a lecture circuit or whatever, if people were willing to pay me and listen to me. You and I and a lot of other people in our shoes have accumulated a massive wealth of weird music nerdery knowledge.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm just not sure how we can harness all of this power, but there's a lot of power there.
Agreed. Where can people find you online?
I'm not on Facebook, but I am on Instagram at PeaceLock70. Unless, of course, you are upset and you were there, then don't at me, bro. I don't want to hear it, man. I heard it when Diamond D got mad at me. I heard it from other people. And I want to shout out all of the New York dudes from that era who actually have been very gracious and very amazing to me. Greg Nice. And, there's a ton of people. But Greg comes to mind first, who were there and who have been very, very gracious and nice. So shout out all the New York cats who took us under our wings, and middle finger to everyone else who was upset.
By the way, folks, if you liked Illmatic, and hopefully if this is your first time listening to this album, I'm jealous for you because you got to listen to Illmatic for the first time, or maybe it was your 18th time. But normally we do a recommendation of what else you should check out. For my personal one, I would suggest that what comes to mind is Jay-Z's Reasonable Doubt, came out.
I don't like that record.
I'm going to recommend Reasonable Doubt by Jay-Z, which came out in 96, partly because it also has not in the same kind of Dream Team way, but it does have a selection of different prominent producers. Ski worked on it, Premier again, Clark Kent, Big Jazz had, I think, one or two tracks. And I think it makes for an interesting contrast because Jay-Z, even though from a career point of view, he had been along much longer than Nas had before Illmatic. Jay was still kind of in this formative stage. He'd kind of reinvented himself from his Hawaiian Sophie days in the early 90s. And I think it makes for an interesting contrast. I'm not saying Reasonable Doubt is as good as an album. It doesn't sound like Illmatic, but I do think it's an interesting debut album to contrast with Illmatic, partly because Jay had the benefit of having heard Illmatic, a couple years before, and knowing that for his own debut, how to kind of engineer it in both literal and figurative ways. And I think it makes for an interesting contrast.
If you're feeling rich, even if it ain't sunny, hey, I ain't complaining. I'm in the rain, doing the buck 40, hydroplaning. What's shorty?
Where you disappeared, son?
Maintaining, putting myself in no position. Most of these rappers ain't in. I'm living.
I happen to really like Reasonable Doubt.
That's why I'm giving you a hard time.
But whatever. So, Thess, what would you recommend for people who liked Illmatic? What do you think they should check out, especially from a producer's point of view?
Yeah, I think if Illmatic is something that you're really into, then I think it's worth working backwards. Working backwards a little bit in the sense that, Main Source Breaking Atoms was a sea change when it comes to production, technique, and style. I think Showbiz and AG's Runaway Slave,
yes,
from a lyrical and from a music standpoint, is unbelievably great. And then, of course, Premier and his work with Gangstar. I'm basically listening my favorite albums from all the producers. But I do think that of all those people would be least likely to go back and listen to Breaking Atoms.
Yes.
So I would start there.
Yeah.
It's an underrated album. It's an amazing
Absolutely.
Album. And I also think that Showbiz and AG, Runaway Slave, is worth listening to. And if you want to hear how we got from horns, how the horns ended up sounding like they do on this record,
yeah,
how the filters and the sampling ended up how it was, that's a really important record, right, and underrated as well.
Understand your choice of man. They speak proper while my speech is from a garbage can. But regardless, you shouldn't have to be so raw. I'm looking at the front door. I'm looking at the front door. Baby, I'm looking at the front door.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong. Morgan Rhodes will be back next week. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup. Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows. Senior producer is Laura Swisher, and exec producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.